Alex Makarowski is a 2019 Commonwealth Bank John Monash Scholar. He has a Master's of Mathematical Modelling and Scientific Computing and is using equations to help solve the world's looming energy problems as we move towards a net zero economy. For his scholarship, he studied at Oxford University in the UK, and he's recently back in Australia. Alex, welcome to the program.
Lovely to be here. Thank you very much, Justin.
So you're joining us from Adelaide, South Australia this morning. Has that always been home for you?
Yeah. I was born and raised in Adelaide, and I worked here for a couple of years, and I'm looking forward to working here for another few years to come.
Okay, so you're freshly back home from the UK. Did you have to quarantine upon coming home?
Yes, I did 2 weeks of quarantine in the Howard Springs facility in the Northern Territory.
Okay.
Yeah, so to be honest, actually, I found it very relaxing. I needed some sleep after finishing my dissertation at Oxford. So the staff were very professional, and getting some sun and fresh air in Howard Springs. They have little verandas in the setups in Howard Springs, and staff were extremely professional. So I found it more than manageable, which was great.
So what was it like up there?
In some ways it feels kind of surreal, because you know there are police and of course lots of staff that are walking around in all sorts of PPE, so you feel unclean, even though you know that the vast majority of people are fine and so on. But so it definitely kind of has that institutional vibe, I guess you could say. But I think everyone sort of understood what was happening. There was actually a thunderstorm on day seven, so about halfway through, and they texted everyone saying that there was a chance we'd lose power, and the timing was most unfortunate, because I had the defense of my dissertation, so the last hurdle for my Oxford degree that was scheduled for an hour later. So
heavens opened.
Yeah, exactly. But I was really quite fortunate that, you know, the power managed to stay on. I was able to sort of do my defense over Teams with the various professors and so on from Oxford.
So you did all of that from quarantine in the Northern Territory?
From quarantine, that's right. Yeah, so they had to work it out with the time zones and that kind of thing. So I think it was about 7 or 8 o'clock at night in quarantine. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning over in the UK for the professors.
Hey, well, when you're in quarantine, are you allowed to move around at all? Or once you're in your cabin, like, that's it, you can't move. You've got your veranda and that's about it.
It's pretty much just the veranda. So I was, you can go on the veranda and sort of do a little bit of exercise. Like, yeah, I did quite a lot of abs and legs and that kind of thing there on the veranda, just getting some sun in the mornings, trying to keep a bit of a schedule, I think is good for avoiding going crazy. And the only other really place you're able to kind of walk around is if you're going to the laundry room every couple of days. You can go and do your washing. But apart from that, you're pretty much just in your veranda and in your room.
Did you meet any veranda buddies across across the hall?
I did, actually, yes, because they were in, so the buildings were kind of in pods of four, four rooms, and then opposite that was another pod of four. So you're able to kind of, if you're sitting on the veranda, there might be sort of, especially around dinner time, there might be kind of four or five other people where you can have a bit of a good chat with, and some really interesting stories from the people around me, like some people that had their flights cancelled like four or five times. Another lady was working for the NHS when COVID was really, really ramping up in the UK. So so some great stories. I think having those conversations as well is also great for keeping people's mental health during quarantine.
I bet. So when you were doing the defense of your dissertation, how nerve-wracking is that, knowing that you've put so much into it and you've now got to defend it all in front of some pretty smart people?
It was definitely nerve-wracking. I don't think there's a soul alive that can tell you going through that an experience like that wasn't at least nerve-wracking in some way. I think you just have to a certain extent, you do have to just kind of place a little bit of faith in your supervisors and your course mates as well. So I was really fortunate to have some really close course mates, and so we would before we had presentations or something like that at Oxford, we would kind of we would often practice in front of each other. And so, okay. in particular, a really close mate of mine, we called, four or five days prior, and just sort of worked through different sections of our dissertation and brainstorms ideas, they could say. And so you just try and prepare yourself as best you can. Put some faith in your supervisor that they've, because if you had actually presented something that was really quite substandard, I think it would kind of reflect on them a little bit as well.
Yes.
So, you just have to have some faith in the system there. Try and put on a smile and a nice shirt on the day, and that's all you can do, really. So,
hope for the best.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. I had to go for a patterned shirt because I couldn't iron anything else in quarantine, but I don't think they noticed. So,
I don't think you're gonna get marked down because of your wardrobe.
No, hopefully not. Exactly. Yeah.
So have you finished now, or is it all done?
It is all done. Yeah, which it just feels surreal. It just feels like it passed in a blink of an eye. You know, there was just an immense amount of it was a very big year. When some of my friends ask me about it, I just think about, wow, I didn't know any of those people that I now consider my really, really close friends a year ago. You know, I didn't know all these different kinds of techniques and programming skills that I kind of really picked up and developed during the course a year ago. So I definitely think I came a long way in terms of technically and learning about the course and all these, and just a whole life experience as well, you know, living in another country. That was also something that was quite different for me for a prolonged period of time. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, of course, the pandemic, you know, through the bad times and the good times in the UK, it just, there were really bad months and months when, you know, like seeing those really special times, you know, being able to kind of go catch up with people outdoor again for the first time in a beer garden, you know, when the UK opened, those kinds of, the first time we could kind of see each other in the Maths Institute after the big lockdown in the winter of January, February 2021. Really special times.
Well, let's talk about that. You were in the UK studying at Oxford, obviously in the grip of the pandemic. Give us some insights as to what that was like.
Yeah, it was really incredible. So it went through good times and bad times. So when I first arrived in the UK, if I remember correctly, the UK was getting about 3,500 cases a day across the whole nation, which per capita is really not a lot, you know, especially, you know, you can think about just Victoria alone is getting the best part of 2,000. Obviously, the UK is a much bigger population. So really, when I first arrived, there was not a lot of COVID transmission going around.
Yes.
However, I think as the weather got colder, you know, viruses, to my understanding, live a bit longer in colder weather and people spending more time indoors and so on. The numbers began to accelerate. And so there was about 30 or 40,000 cases a day sort of by December. Someone in my household, unfortunately tested positive. And so we had to isolate, for 2 weeks, which was very stressful, I might add.
How was that?
Yeah, it was definitely, So I remember he sent a message to our house group chat, as it were, and then exactly, and no one this guy was quite quiet, and so no one really, because you know, he'd told us about the test and everything, but he basically went to the lab and Tesco, so we weren't really too concerned. But then when he said it was positive, I was in the middle of this numerical linear algebra tutorial at the time, and I remember just having absolutely no
as you do
yeah I couldn't concentrate at all at what the tutor asked what I thought about a question at one point, and I said, look, I'm sorry, I'm just a little bit distracted right now. It was just, because you think
I might have been exposed to a deadly virus.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you just think about, but obviously, like, logistically, it's kind of cancelling all the plans you had for the 2 weeks. I was very fortunate, you know, no one else in the house tested positive, which was great. So he did a really good job of isolating himself. And we also set up, like a schedule for all the shared spaces in the house. And then, so he would go right at the end of the day and kind of leave everything open and ventilated. But it was scary, you know, it's, especially living in Australia, I speak to lots of my friends and, you know, they say, look, that we hardly know anyone, if they know anyone that has ever had it. And, you know, I could name yeah, probably a dozen, two dozen people in Oxford, friends of mine that got it while I was over there. So, yeah, that it was quite scary.
How did it affect your studies? Obviously, apart from being locked down for a couple of weeks, did it impact the way you attended classes and learned?
Yeah, so Oxford's academic year is divided into those three terms and then the summer. And so my program also ran across the summer. So the first term, Michaelmas, we were quite lucky because the numbers started out from quite a low base. So we were able to have some lectures in person and then our tutorials in person. So that was, we were basically, there was a lecture hall, which normally seats about 200, and we would sort of be in there with, you know, at most 20 people and all kind of spread out and with masks. And so the first time was really, we were quite lucky. And then there was a room in the Mathematical Institute, which was sort of just for our master's program. And we could meet up and kind of collaborate on some whiteboards there, or masked up and so on. So that was, and I think that was really, really pivotal that we did have some face-to-face time, because we could sort of meet up and bond. And really sort of develop, because mathematics is, it's not a, as much as people think sometimes that, you know, it's not an individual pursuit at all. And there's lots of, there really is a lot of
collaboration.
Exchange. Yes, it's a very collaborative discipline. And especially with the pace of the material that we were covering, some of the, you'd look at some of the problem sheets and there would be, you know how to do sort of two or three questions out of about eight or nine, and then, you know, and your mate would know another two or three, and then you sort of meet up and collaborate, and then eventually someone else would figure out another one. So it was a very collaborative discipline. And then the second term, so Hillary, so the numbers in the UK really got quite high over winter in January, February, so sort of in excess of 60,000 a day. And the vaccine program had started, but by no means was as advanced as it is now. So there were several hundred, I think it's some days even more than 1,000 people passed away. So that was really, so everything was moved online.
That's awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really quite hard. But fortunately, because we'd kind of made those relationships in the first term, I felt quite comfortable, you know, calling friends on Teams, and we would kind of call once or twice a day just to kind of collaborate. And I think that we got through some really dark times like that, building those relationships in the first term. And then from about April and May, the vaccination program in the UK had really advanced quite a bit, and things were better. We were back in the Maths Institute. The days were just sunnier as well, so people's mood was better, I guess.
It's always nice when the sun comes out, especially in England.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I didn't, you know, it was not something I was quite prepared for as well, but especially growing up in Adelaide, it's always normally quite sunny here, even in winter. Yeah. But the COVID definitely had a second wind with Delta, and Oxford was leading. I think they were leading all the UK counties in terms of per capita infections for a few weeks there. So that was also, they were, the UK government deployed these testing vans just on the side of streets, and so you could just walk around. As I was walking to the Maths Institute, you could drop into the van and get a test. And then, so because it was a little bit
quick little COVID test.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, so that was a little bit of a perfect storm, I think, because obviously the vaccinations were rolled out sort of in descending order of need. So that is in descending age. And then so for the university towns and populations, it meant that a lot of the young people were some of the last to be vaccinated. And especially these, especially uni students who were really kind of, I think, quite starved, and some of the undergrads, you know, were really quite keen to meet and mingle and so on during the last term. It meant that it blew up a little bit. But look, so definitely it had its ups and downs, and but it's that was the progression of the virus. And
you would have been there when it all started opening up again.
Yes, I was. I remember it quite vividly.
What did you do? That would have been amazing after all those months in lockdown.
It was amazing. I think we went to the Turf. I think I went to the Turf with some of my housemates, the Turf Tavern. That's the pub where I think Bob Hawke broke the world record for sculling a yacht of ale. Yeah, so, and I think we went there and had.
Did you follow in his footsteps?
No, I'm not even sure they serve yacht glasses anymore, and I don't think I could be anywhere near 11 seconds. But I think I'd embarrass myself. But but they were really. So I think we went to the Turf Tavern, and Yeah, just a few little mundane things as well, because with all the shops being shut and you know, just picking up some extra clothes and that kind of thing. Yeah, just which sounds super mundane, but yeah, you kind of forget how disruptive everything shut is when it's going on.
And now you're back home, and Australia seems to be, hopefully, fingers crossed, getting on top of it as much as you can. But the vaccination rates are certainly heading in the right direction. What are your impressions of Adelaide now? Now that you're back?
Yeah, so it is quite surreal being in, well, I guess, like Adelaide at the moment. You know, they're not currently aware of any community transmission, and it's been like that for some time. You know, there's been a couple of little clusters, especially having being from coming from the UK back to an area that's almost like almost free of the virus like that. It is really strange. You know, I think it's in a bit of a, I think, South Australia, West Australia, Queensland, Northern Territory, Tasmania, they're in a bit of an interesting situation now, because obviously, you know, there's many families which are split between states, and especially with the bigger states. And so everyone wants to see each other again for Christmas and so on and so forth. Yeah, but at the same time, keeping the virus out saves lives. But I think people are gradually understanding now that, you know, and hopefully, especially the numbers in Sydney where the vaccination rates are most advanced, and in New South Wales, that if the hospital load is manageable, and you know, there's relatively minimal risk of overloading the health system, that we can then open up and rejoin the eastern states and the international world. Yes, yeah, so I'm hopeful that can come soon.
Yeah,
very exciting.
And so now that you're back home, what's the plan? Is there a plan? What are you going to be doing for work?
So I used to work at the Australian Energy Market Operator, and tomorrow I start a new role at the University of New South Wales, and it's also in collaboration with AEMO, so I'm kind of split between those organisations. So previously at AEMO I worked in sort of system security analysis, so in particular in an advisory role. So as I'm sure everyone's aware, there's lots of rooftop solar going into the national electricity market, and in particular in
everywhere.
Yes, it is everywhere. Yeah, and in particular in South Australia has a really high penetration of we call it DER, distributed energy resources, which is that rooftop solar. And so managing the grid when there is a really high amount of DER is something that's almost new for system operators around the world. You know, so we're talking on a good Sunday in South Australia, rooftop solar can be sort of in excess of 80% of the state's electricity demand, which is really phenomenal. However, I guess, like, if you think about the old school power system, so say if we were to go back in time sort of 15 years ago in South Australia, maybe 8 or 9 gas or coal units would sort of be operating simultaneously to meet the state's demand.
Yeah,
and then so if the energy market had a significant stress event, so say South Australia would disconnect from Victoria, which does happen during you know, extreme weather events, then it would have to operate independently. Mm-hmm. And so in particular, so I was doing some analysis around, okay, so in the past we would sort of be 8 or 9 units operating together in South Australia. And then if an individual unit tripped in that electrical island, it was relatively straightforward for the other 7 or 8 units to ramp up and correct the imbalance in supply and demand, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So, yeah, so then, but fast forward to today, and okay, if that same separation event were to happen, there might only be 80% of the demand might be met by rooftop solar. So that means that there might only be sort of, say 3 conventional generators online in South Australia. And it's a lot harder for 3 generators to spot each other in the way that 8 or 9 could in that sort of electrical system.
Get it. Yep.
So in particular, how do we quantify the benefits of new technologies such as like the grid scale batteries that are in operation in South Australia? And then also a technology called synchronous condensers, which also helps sort of slow down the grid and give it more time to respond when there are significant disturbances.
So what was it that made you interested in this area?
So I guess I think living in South Australia during a little blackout event of a little blackout event.
I think everyone remembers that little blackout event.
Yeah, everyone kind of remembers where they were and so on. So I think that definitely that was a big moment in South Australia. I think that in particular sort of spurred a lot more interest in energy from myself personally. I think growing up, I was always interested in longer term around climate change and how are we going to source our energy and so on and so forth. But that kind of made me realize there's also system security problems that people don't fully understand. And in particular as well, some of the policy decisions from like the state government and some of the rhetoric from the federal government around there was also really interesting to watch. So, like, at least from the state government's perspective, they spent tens of millions of dollars on the Hornsdale Energy Reserves. That's the big grid scale battery. And I think you might recall the tweets between like Elon Musk and Mike Cannon Brooks and so on.
Yes, I do.
So that particular asset has been a commercial success, and it's kind of paved the way for lots of other grid scale energy storage and other technologies that can provide what we call fast frequency response that can kick in really quickly and sort of spot other units that are generating. However, they also spent quite a lot of money. I think it's $250 million on these diesel generators that kind of came in shipping containers, and I think they were turned on once or something before they were then resold by the next government. So you can kind of, so energy is just energy policy. It's a lot of money can be spent really quickly, and in particular, if there's not a real understanding of the issues at stake, it can be spent completely fruitlessly.
Suboptimally.
So, yes. Yeah. So,
have you got a view on how both the South Australian government and the Commonwealth are faring in relation to energy policy?
Yeah. So I think in terms of the Labor government at a state level. Personally, yeah. So I think, like I've already kind of mentioned, Hornsdale in particular was a goal. I think that was a good technology, and I think that everyone's kind of happy that that's installed in the grid, and it provides a good role in our system security. Mm-hmm. The decision to purchase the diesel generators, I think probably in hindsight, probably not so a good idea. Yeah. And then the current state government, has been pushing ahead with managing vast quantities of rooftop solar, and they've been quite active in sort of engaging with AEMO and other stakeholders, that's the Australian Energy Market Operator, on what needs to be done to manage vast quantities of renewable energy. So I think that's a tick for them, and I also understand that they support the South Australia New South Wales interconnector and had supported that project, that proposal, which I also personally, I also think that's a very important piece of infrastructure. So that's on the state level. Federally, I guess federal energy policies change a lot without putting too fine a point on it recently. I think that they're
being very diplomatic here, Alex. That's okay.
No, I think like that there are good projects like Snowy Hydro 2.0. I think will be very important in terms of energy storage and sort of soaking up demand during the middle of the day when we're seeing a lot of pricing events negative pricing events in the NEM. So proposals like that, I think, are good. And then we'll kind of see what happens. I think that there is still a big question mark around what the energy system is going to look like in 10 years' time, and I think I would like to see the federal government continue to engage with stakeholders and so on.
So what was it that made you go for the scholarship through the John Monash Foundation, and why did you choose Oxford University?
Well, I had a really incredible tutor at the University of Adelaide in my first year, and her name was Kelly, and for mathematics. And she was going off to do a PhD at Oxford, or as I say in Oxford, a DPhil. So I was in Europe for a conference in 2017, and I knew I was thinking about further study And at the time, you know, I knew my grades were okay and so on. And so I thought, well, you know, why don't I go to Oxford? That's right. And sort of have a chat with Kelly. And she was, she met up with me and, you know, spent a lot of days. It was right at the heart of summer in 2017, which was maybe a little bit not quite realistic in terms of what the UK would be like for the whole year. But Oxford in the summer, it was just, everything was, it's a very walkable city. You know, all the plants were blooming. Kelly showed me around the Mathematical Institute, you know, and it's a beautiful institute. I can't think of too many ways how you would improve an environment to do and ask questions and learn mathematics like that. Like there's, in terms of the caliber of the people that are walking around, you can have conversations with and play football, soccer with if you'd like to, table soccer.
You can do everything.
Yeah. And you know, there's like when I was in Oxford, you know, Roger Penrose was walking around. He was awarded his Nobel Prize and was interviewed by the BBC like 10 meters away from my room. You know, Andrew Wiles, like, you know, arguably very famous mathematician, so proved Fermat's Last Theorem. You know, some people think it's one of the greatest mathematical achievements to happen this millennium to date. He's just walking around, you know, having lunch outside, and it was quite funny. One of my course mates, and towards the end of our time there. He goes up to Mr. Wiles, and the proof itself is famously—it's 200 pages. I think it's almost 200 pages long, and you need many, many, many years of study in number theory to sort of understand what's going on. And my course mate just kind of comes up to him, and he was like, "Oh, hi, Andrew. You know, I'm a big fan." He's like, "Are you able to just give me a quick run through of your proof?" Kind of thing. And Andrew Wiles,
where should I start?
Yeah, Andrew Wiles just kind of laughed and so on. And but yeah, it's like I had lectures there, and I remember in first term I didn't quite understand the concept of that was being introduced in one of these lectures. So I went to the Wikipedia page for the concept, as most students do. And 60% of the references on the Wikipedia page were from the textbook that was written by the lecturer. You know what I mean? So you really are. Just the caliber of the mathematics.
You're on the front line of learning.
Yes, it's just incredible. Like another anecdote. So I remember being in the lecture hall, and there was a picture of and it was like the first equals sign written ever, and it was a picture of that, you know, from I think it was from the 13th century or something like that. You know, and that book where someone first wrote an equals sign, you know, is in the Bodleian Library somewhere in Oxford, and you kind of step back for a minute and you go, oh my lord, like how did people do mathematics without an equals sign for 1200 years? It just so the caliber of the education was exceptional. Kelly, my tutor at Adelaide, really promoted it. She spoke very highly of it. So it just seemed like an incredible environment. So that was what led me to the scholarship.
And you got the scholarship. And what did you do? It's a Masters of Science in Mathematical Modeling and Scientific Computing, according to my notes. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So it's an Applied Mathematics Masters. So at the Maths Institute, the teaching is kind of divided between a sort of Applied Maths and Pure Maths. And so it's all about, I guess the philosophy of the course can be described by, okay, if there's a problem or a phenomenon we want to understand and model, how do we go about modeling, how do we go about building a mathematical model for that? How do we go about then solving that model using like probably numerical techniques and sort of understanding and interpreting the results? And so we did we studied all kinds of systems. So like invasive species models, for instance, different squirrel populations in the UK, tumor growth modeling. I did an assignment on epidemiology, so in particular on rubella and the rollout of the rubella vaccination. Another one on different metals cooling within an alloy. Just all these really incredible systems. And then my dissertation was on lithium ion batteries, so in particular types of batteries, some of the batteries that are used within electric vehicles. And in particular around
your iPhones.
Yes, exactly right. So in particular around the thermal management of keeping them sufficiently cool is very important. Obviously, everyone remembers that the Samsung Galaxy.
I remember.
Yes, phenomenon with the exploding phones, and But in particular, it's not just safety, it's also the efficiency of the battery itself. So if a battery is too hot for too long, it'll begin to degrade, sort of lose its capacity and its peak power output. And so in particular for electric vehicles, that's a really, really critical, you really want to reduce that rate of degradation as much as you can. Because if you've got an electric vehicle battery that's degrading very quickly, it means you have to change the batteries. You might have to do that two or three times over the lifetime of the car. And it can completely change the economics about whether or not that's a viable investment for someone. So there was an engineering study that was done. And it was, so if you imagine these kind of rectangular, these sort of thin rectangular batteries. And in particular, the study, and he basically, this engineer, cooled the battery on different surfaces. So there are these big, large front and back surfaces, as opposed to these sort of thinner side surfaces. And just the choice of cooling on the different sides of the battery was found to affect the rate of degradation by a factor of three, which sounds not, what does that mean? Or it can mean like a $15,000 or $20,000 difference in terms of the life cycle cost of ownership for the vehicle. So my dissertation looked at sort of examining, well, why are some faces better than others to cool lithium-ion batteries? How do you go about managing that cooling of the battery and building models that can actually simple enough to be solved and meaningful for engineers and so on?
Well, Alex, it's been great catching up with you on the podcast today. Welcome back to Australia. Welcome home, and all the very best for the years ahead. It's been a real pleasure having you join us on the program. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Justin. It's been a pleasure to be on.